Good morning and welcome to Truth and Justice Radio. With us today is David Ray Griffin, and he's going to be speaking at Boston University coming up on April 11th, 2009. Well, David, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you.
Now, can you give us a few highlights from the lecture tour that you're currently on and the overall significance of what you have to speak about?
Well, I'm calling the lecture 9/11, Time for a Second Look, and I suggest this for several reasons. One obvious one, of course, is that the Bush-Cheney gang is out of power, and the significance of that shouldn't be overlooked. There has been enormous fear in the country, in the media, and so on, because of what people have feared that the Bush and perhaps particularly Cheney might do, having at their disposal the Secret Service and the CIA and the FBI and so on, the IRS. And so it's possible now that some people who would like to come out and speak publicly might do so if there was a forum where they were encouraged to do that. Likewise, some people who didn't even want to look at the evidence before because they didn't want to know, you know, there's that famous statement by Sinclair Lewis that it's very difficult to get a man to understand something if his salary depends on his not understanding it. A journalist named John Gleason was just fired in Canada for writing a positive story about the 9/11 movement. So that phenomenon sent a chill through the news media right after 9/11 when some people spoke up in a very mild way and lost their jobs. So that's one factor. A second factor is that whereas at one time people could say, oh, the 9/11 movement is just a bunch of kids on the Internet, a bunch of conspiracy wackos who really know nothing about the real world, we now have all these professional organizations, architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, with over 600 licensed architects and engineers who have been willing to sign a statement saying we need a new investigation. We have pilots for 9/11 Truth, veterans for 9/11 Truth, and a lot of former military officers. More recently, we've got religious leaders for 9/11 Truth, lawyers for 9/11 Truth, medical professionals for 9/11 Truth, and the newest organization is political leaders for 9/11 Truth. We have already over 40 members, and about half of those are quite high-level members, people who have been senators in various countries and so on. And so when you look at the present makeup of the 9/11 movement, people who rolled their eyes before might give a second look and say, well, gee, if all those people with those kinds of expertise believe something's wrong with the official story, maybe we should give it a second look. So those are some of the reasons.
Let's talk a bit about some of the flaws in the official story. It's hard to actually pick where to start here because from pretty much every angle and every aspect of any importance, the story that the government puts forward doesn't hold water. The 9/11 Truth Commission has many glaring flaws and defects. Wonder if you could hit some of the highlights. For example, the NIST studies that have been done, if you could speak about those.
Well, yes, I'm just, in fact, finishing up a book on the NIST report on World Trade Center 7. NIST, of course, is the National Institute of Standards and Technology. It was given the task of coming up with the official reports on why the Twin Towers and Building 7 came down. They put out the report on the Twin Towers back in 2005. They were supposed to put out the report on Building 7 at the same time, but they didn't. They said, well, we're not quite finished yet. We'll have it next year. Well, next year came, and they said, well, we're not finished yet. We'll have it next year. Next year came and said, So finally they put it out just before the Bush-Cheney administration was ready to leave office. Now, why might they have wanted that to be delayed? By the way, NIST is not an independent scientific organization. It's an agency of the Commerce Department, and therefore for the last 8 years it's been an agency of the Bush-Cheney administration. So obviously it couldn't say anything that the Bush-Cheney administration didn't want them to say. And they were greatly supervised. Everything, we've got a whistleblower who's come out who used to work there, and he said everything had to be passed through the front office, through the Commerce Department, and even through the White House and the National Security Agency. Well, the problem was that with the Twin Towers, they could come up with a story that would pass muster with the gullible press, or at least the press that pretends to be gullible, and with the general public by saying, oh, well, the planes hit those buildings and destabilized them, and then there were those enormous jet fuel-fed fires, and those buildings just couldn't withstand that. And, of course, that was all nonsense. But to the layperson who didn't know anything about these towers and their 287 steel columns and all that and the history of steel frame high-rise buildings that they've never come down for any reason other than explosives, for the general public, that could pass muster. But what were they going to do with Building 7, which wasn't hit by a plane? Therefore, it had no jet fuel in it. Therefore, it didn't have any big fires. It had fires on a few of the building 47 floors. Well, they have come up with a totally implausible and even contradictory report. That for a long time, they refused to admit that the building went into free fall. Now, free fall means that the top of the building was coming down through the bottom part of the building, or where the bottom part of the building was supposed to be, at the same speed that if you had dropped a brick off the building, it would have come down. In other words, it was coming down at the speed that gravity would have pulled it down.
So the structure provided no resistance whatsoever to the
descent. That means the structure was supplying zero resistance, and that can only happen if explosives have been put in there to remove all of that steel and concrete. And so the lead investigator, Shyam Sunder, had explained at a technical briefing that he gave back in August of 2008 that, no, the building couldn't have come down in free fall because, you know, you've got this little pesky thing that Newton pointed out, the law of the conservation of energy and momentum. So it couldn't come down at free fall because that stuff that was there and would offer resistance. Well, a high school physics teacher got on YouTube and put out a video. His name was David Chandler, and showed everybody that you can measure it, and it did come down at free fall. He presented this at NIST technical briefing, and they were confronted with irrefutable evidence. So in their final report, they said, well, for 2.25 seconds, as David Chandler put it, a whopping 2.25 seconds, the building was in free fall. Well, their own theory, they didn't change their theory. Their theory still says free fall is impossible, and yet they empirically admitted free fall occurred. So they have an enormous contradiction in their official final version, and yet when they presented their draft report back in August, the first report they put out for public comment, and that was what Chandler had commented on, they had come in with a bunch of fanfare and said, the mystery of World Trade Center 7 is solved. And now in the final report, they reinstate the mystery. How does the building fall at free fall speed, even though explosives were not used to remove the lower structure?
And also while exhibiting classic signs of controlled demolition, the crank in the middle of the building prior to the collapse of the structure.
Yeah, and this is the other thing, and I go through, and the name of my book that I'm just going to send into the press this week, so it won't be out probably for about 3 months yet, is called The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7, Why the Final Official Report About 9/11 is Unscientific and False. And I really stress the fact that NIST, which is supposed to be a scientific technological agency, has put out perhaps the most unscientific report in history. I mean, that's pretty extreme, but it certainly would be second to none. All the basic principles of science that they violate, and one of them, there is such a thing called scientific fraud, and the three main categories of fraud are falsification of data, fabrication of data, plagiarism, and then there's a fourth that's really put under falsification, but it's really a distinct one, which is simply covering up evidence that doesn't fit your theory. And they do that with a vengeance. And so you've got all this steel that was melted, and you have all these people testifying that there was melted steel, and NIST simply ignores it. And there were pieces of steel that were found that were oxidized and sulfidized, which actually boiled, so they were vaporized, which means it got up to something like 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit,
where
fires could not have gotten over, say, 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit. And they said, well, we couldn't study any steel from the building because no steel from World Trade Center 7 was found. And yet in the appendix to the FEMA report, which came out in 2002, which NIST was supposed to be building on, there's a report about a piece of steel found from World Trade Center 7, which was this piece that was oxidized and sulfidized and vaporized. So they just lie when they don't want to admit the data.
Could it be possible also that part of the sulfidation that was found was from thermate?
Quite possible. They claim, oh, no, you've got gypsum wallboard and that has sulfur in it, so that explains the sulfur. Well, the point is that the sulfur entered into the intergranular structure of the steel, and that doesn't happen just because gypsum comes out of the board and is there. In the, it would have to be there with the steel at temperatures of several thousand degrees.
Which, incidentally, is the range for thermate, which is, I believe, close to 4,500 degrees centigrade.
That's right. Well, what you have is, the basic thing is called thermite, and there are many different kinds of thermite. If you add sulfur to thermite, it becomes thermate, and that greatly lowers the temperature at which steel will melt. So it makes it much easier to apply steel, to cut steel, which is what you have to do to remove, in this case, the 82 columns that put up the building. For it to come straight down the way it did, as you said, into a nice tidy little pile into its own footprint, all 82 steel columns had to fail simultaneously, or else the building would have fallen over sideways. And, you know, that doesn't just happen because they all happen to get heated up by fires here and there in the building.
Especially in a basement, because you have to take the bottom side out for the building to be able to collapse in a controlled fashion. Which brings me to a question I have not found an answer to elsewhere. Perhaps you will know. There is an iconic photograph, at this point I'd say iconic, of a large rectangular column severed at beyond a 45-degree angle with slag below the cut. I'm assuming you have seen that photograph.
Yeah, the problem is that I never refer to it because the problem is we can't prove when that was done.
That was
anybody
exactly.
Who wants to defend the official story can come in and say, oh, look, that was just one of the columns that was still sticking up in the air, so the guys came in with the torch and cut it down, and cut it down at an angle. So it's suspicious, but we can't use it for proof.
Thank you for clearing that up. If I can return back for just a moment to the NIST studies or reports, talk to us about Philip Zelikow.
Okay, yeah, he was the head, not of NIST, but of the 9/11 Commission. And you had asked about that earlier, the 9/11 Commission report. And it was no more independent from the Bush administration than the NIST report was, because Zelikow was essentially a member of the Bush-Cheney White House. he and Condoleezza Rice had been on the National Security Council back during the presidency of the first President Bush. They became friends, and then when the Republicans were out of office during the Clinton years, they wrote a book together. And I've written a book with someone, and I know you've got to be very close to that person, both in your thinking and in your friendship, to survive such a thing. And then she brought him back in when she became appointed National Security Advisor for the new President Bush. She brought him in to help with the transition to the new National Security Council. Not only that, she then had the task of writing this document called National Security Strategy of the United States of America 2002. And a first draft was written by a fellow in the State Department. She didn't like it, said we need something bolder. So she brings in her old friend Philip Zelikow to take charge of writing this document. Well, this turns out to be the document that was used as the rationale for attacking Iraq. Because what he did, with her cooperation, of course, was to articulate a new doctrine of preemptive warfare. The old doctrine said, this follows the United Nations principles, that you can't attack another country unless you know with certain knowledge that it is ready to attack you, the attack is imminent, too imminent to take it to the UN Security Council. He said, well, given 9/11, we can't afford that luxury anymore. We've got to be able to attack other countries before they're strong enough to attack us. So that was the rationale used for Iraq. You know, they knew they didn't have any weapons of mass destruction, but they figured, well, you know, maybe 5 years from now, 10 years from now, they're going to do it, so let's attack them now so we'll cripple them. And he's the one who writes that. He uses 9/11 as the basis for articulating that new doctrine, which, incidentally, Cheney and other neocons had been wanting for a long time. So this was the excuse to do it. And then, of all things, then Zelikow is brought in to head up the 9/11 commission, which should have been asking, among other questions, might the White House have had some reason to orchestrate or at least allow 9/11, and of course it had like five good reasons, but this was one of them. And so here he's the person who used 9/11 to give the White House something they had wanted, and he's supposed to be in charge of this neutral 9/11 commission.
This touches a bit on one of the larger sort of underlying questions of, if indeed this was a false flag attack, which all indications seem to be that it was, who put this together? Who had enough reach to be able to clear the way for such an event? And how did they manage to actually pull it off?
I don't get into the question so much of what really happened. My focus is on the official story is false. Therefore, we need a new investigation. But that said, we certainly can tell by what kinds of lies they tell who was central to the operation. So one of the big lies is told about Dick Cheney. Another big lie is told about General Myers, who was then, he was the acting chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff that day. And then another lie is told about Donald Rumsfeld. These were lies about where they were that morning. And so you can figure that those were three of the people in operational charge of the day. And, of course, Cheney had formerly been the Secretary of Defense himself. So he knew how the Defense Department operated, and he knew how interceptions are made and how the FAA works together with the military to intercept planes. So he would have known, as well as Rumsfeld and Myers, what sorts of things had to be done to make sure that, you know, the plan went off somewhat as planned.
You see, this is where the story gets so interesting because just the complexity involved between the military exercises, NORAD being waved off, the Air Force being called to stand down. It seems like so many moving pieces to have to coordinate. And yet, even though many news reports stated the obvious, the stories were changed around, so I guess we shouldn't find it too surprising that revisionism has had free rein with large swaths of this story.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Yeah, you know, you've got to remember, military operations are big deals, and that's what these guys spend their whole life getting ready to do and then planning. You know, it's not something you do in your spare time. You go to military school, you learn all these things. And, for example, interceptions are practiced incessantly. They even have contests between different groups to see who can cut two or three seconds off the record for intercepting a plane once they get a notice and so on. Likewise, if you know, go back and look at the planning of D-Day, for example, and you'll see this is a very intricate organization that takes a long time planning, and lots of people involved, and these things have to come off with quite a bit of precision, and they quite often do. That said, let me back up what I said about Cheney for people who may not know this to show the extent and the brazenness of the lies. Everybody in the White House who was involved knew that morning that Cheney went down to the underground bunker, which is the emergency operations room, and that he went down there about 10 after or 15 after 9 that morning. That is shortly after the South Tower, the second tower, was hit. His photographer said this. Richard Clark said it, who was running the operation in the video conference in the White House. He reported in his book, Against All Enemies, that Cheney went down there quite shortly. And then when Norman Mineta, the Secretary of Transportation, got there, Clark told him, go on down there and join Cheney. And Mineta said he got down there about 9:20, and yeah, Cheney was already there. In fact, he was involved in an ongoing conversation with a young man who kept coming in the room and saying, Mr. Vice President, that plane is now 50 miles out, and it's 30 miles out, now it's 10 miles out. Do the orders still stand? Cheney says, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything different? Well, of course, that was a very dangerous story, which Norman Mineta told in an open hearing with the 9/11 Commission that was televised. And so they had to neutralize this story. So they just denied that any of this happened, and they said that Cheney didn't get down there until almost 10 o'clock, perhaps 9:58. Cheney himself, when he was on Tim Russert 5 days after 9/11, had indicated that he had got down there earlier than that, certainly before the Pentagon was attacked. And yet the official story became he didn't get down there until about 20 minutes after the Pentagon was attacked. So, of course, he couldn't have given a stand-down order to let the Pentagon be attacked. So this is so clear. The evidence is so clear that they're lying about Cheney. But this is an example of the fact that the news media simply won't say this. Now, Philip Sheehan wrote this, what looked like a very strong expose of the 9/11 Commission. And he did reveal a lot of things. He revealed that Philip Zelikow lied about his past in order to get the job, and that he kept talking to Karl Rove and Condoleezza Rice after he had promised he would cut off all connections, and that he had actually outlined the 9/11 Commission report before his staff had their very first meeting. So he did reveal a lot of things. But when it came to all these things that showed that the 9/11 Commission was covering up the truth about what happened on 9/11, Philip Sheehan wouldn't say a peep. He wouldn't mention any of these things that Zelikow lied about.
You mentioned the Pentagon, which as with every other aspect of this story, there are many holes in that one as well.
Yeah, we really don't know what happened at the Pentagon, and anybody who claims to know for sure, I wouldn't consider a trustworthy person because they're, or at least a very well-studied person, because there are just so many contradictory phenomena. But what we can say, or at least what I will say, is we can say the official story is false, the official story being that Flight 77, under the control of Hani Hanjour, one of the al-Qaeda hijackers, rammed into the side of the Pentagon. There are just so many facts about that just can't be true. One thing is that Hani Hanjour could hardly fly a little Piper Cub. Trainers wouldn't go up with him a second time because it was too dangerous. And yet he allegedly did an amazing downward spiral with a 757, which he had never been in before. And these take, you know, years of training to go up to the big birds, pilots have told me. And yet he brought it in at ground level at the Pentagon without even scraping the Pentagon lawn, even though the engines stick down below the wings. So it's just an impossible story. Secondly, there's no sign there that either inside or outside the building that a large airplane rammed into it. You've got lots of witnesses, and I report this. This is new evidence I reported in my latest book, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, in the chapter on the Pentagon, that you have just a lot of ordinary Pentagon employees coming to the hole after work saying, oh, boy, I want to see that plane. And they get down there, and everybody says, well, where's the plane? You know, where are the wings? Where's the tail? Where are the engines? There's no sign of a plane here. I even had McQuessy, who was with ABC News, John McQuessy, who got in there, although no news people were supposed to, a friend kind of snuck him in. And he got in there and he said, because outside he didn't see any plane, and so he figured, well, I'm going to go inside and see it. And he said, there was no plane whatsoever. And then he just said, well, the whole plane had vaporized. You know, you can imagine not only aluminum, but the titanium engines vaporized with an ordinary jet fuel fire, which can't get up over 1,800 degrees, say. So that's just part of the evidence that the official story. And one of the most interesting things is, and this is one of the reasons why it's time for a second look, that the FBI now has revealed all sorts of things that contradict the official story, which it was instrumental in putting out in the public mind. One of those things was, of course, that Barbara Olson was on Flight 77, and it was hijacked, and she called her husband, Ted Olson, who was the Solicitor General for the Department of Justice, and told him, Ted, my plane's been hijacked. I'm on Flight 77. And he said she called him twice, and talked to him for about a minute each time. And this was used as proof that Flight 77 was hijacked and that it was still up in the air. If you remember, there was a rumor that Flight 77 had crashed in the Midwest on the Ohio-Kentucky border. But Barbara Olson's call to her husband was taken as proof that it was still up in the air. And, of course, this was the famous call that one of the calls she said, well, the hijackers are armed with knives and box cutters. And of all the alleged phone calls from the planes, this was the only one that mentioned box cutters. So that gives you an idea how important this call was, because everybody knows the hijackers had box cutters. Well, in 2006, the FBI had to present evidence at the trial of Zakariyev Moussaoui. He was the alleged so-called 20th hijacker. And so as part of their evidence, they presented all the records of flights from the four planes. And when they got to Flight 77, they did mention Barbara Olson as having attempted a call. But here's what they said. Barbara Olson, one attempted call, unconnected, 0 seconds. So you have the FBI, which is part of the Department of Justice, saying that this famous story told by Ted Olson, the former Solicitor General of the Department of Justice, that that story is not true. Now, you would think, wouldn't you, in a country with a free press, that the press would, hey, boy, what a scoop. Boy, I can become the reporter. I'll be famous. Not a single reporter has reported this, even though surely one assumes that a few reporters have read my books in which I report this. I've reported it now in 2 books, the book I just mentioned, New Pearl Harbor Revisited, and my previous book, 9/11 Contradictions, subtitled An Open Letter to Congress and the Press, trying to get their attention. So surely a few people did read it, and yet not one of them published an article pointing out that, according to the FBI now, the famous Barbara Olson calls never happened.
David, this is Joe Lopezzi. We've talked before on the phone. I'm the co-founder of the Boston 9/11 Truth Committee, and I just wanted to ask you a question about the Pennsylvania crash site. I mean, I've looked at that a lot, and I've never seen any evidence of a plane crashing there either. No plane, no engines, no bodies, no bags. Have you ever seen any photographic evidence of a plane crashing where they said it crashed?
It's interesting because the reaction of the people who came to that site was just the same as the reaction I just reported at the Pentagon site. People say, well, where's the plane? Where's the plane? You'd think you'd see something. And so we've got 2 planes that crashed that just disappear. Now, the story about the flight, the Shanksville, Pennsylvania crash, is particularly interesting. Here's the explanation as to why nobody saw a flight. I don't know if you know this one. Theory is that the heroic passengers tried to take over the plane, and the hijackers fought them off, but then they were afraid, well, they're going to take over the plane, so let's crash it. So the pilot aims it down, and he's going down there, what, 580 miles an hour, I believe, and he hits that soft Pennsylvania soil, and the whole plane just buries itself in the ground. And so not even the tail section is sticking out of the ground. Joe, that's why nobody saw a plane there.
It is truly amazing.
This is for honest to God, this has been what has been taken to be the kind of definitive book about this flight, or at least the passengers on it, by another New York Times reporter.
I just think it's so telling that the media doesn't even ask a question when they go to the crash site and they see that nothing is there. There's no follow-up questions at all. I mean, why do you think that's the case?
Well, it's what I mentioned earlier, this enormous fear. And I think orders came down from above to the news media, you do not report information contradicting the official story. And here's something that's just that Peter Dale Scott and others are working on now, that the country was put in a state of national security, a national alert, or whatever, forgetting the technical term now. But that means that we're in what is called an emergency situation. And in that situation, normal constitutional principles are temporarily suspended. Well, it is not clear that this was ever lifted. Mm-hmm. And it may be that the press is forbidden by law, this special law, from reporting anything. And so it would be very good. One of the good things the Obama administration could do would be to check into this and get it lifted, because obviously we are no longer in, should no longer be in a state of perpetual national alert.
David, could I shift gears a little? I have just one more question for you. And I wanted to find out from you how you respond when people who have said the same thing to me, they say, well, it would take so many people to be involved in this conspiracy that someone would be speaking. It would be impossible to keep everyone quiet because it would take so many people to be involved. How do you respond to that point?
Yeah, my biggest book about 9/11 is called Debunking, 9/11 Debunking, An Answer to Popular Mechanics and Other Defenders of the Official Conspiracy Theory. And I begin that book by saying the evidence that 9/11 was an inside job is obvious. The only problem is to get people actually to look at the evidence. And so many people, including so many reporters, assume they don't need to look at the evidence because they have all these a priori reasons for saying it just can't be, it couldn't be. One of them is, well, you know, even the Bush administration wouldn't do something this heinous. You know, I used to say that myself, but, you know, finally you've got to look at the evidence and see, well, you know, it looks like they actually did. And likewise with this claim about someone would have talked. And actually, when you start looking at that and see if there's any empirical evidence to support this view that governments cannot keep big operations secret, you find, well, no, it's not well-founded. Take the Manhattan Project, employed about 100,000 people, and yet Harry Truman, the vice president, did not learn that we had created an atomic bomb until after FDR died and Truman became president. Mm-hmm. That's keeping a secret. And there are many other operations that have been kept secret for many, many years. We started a war in Indonesia in 1957. 40,000 Indonesians were killed. Our pilots were flying planes. This was a big operation. We were trying to start a civil war so that we could take control of the island Sumatra that has the oil. Surely somebody, this is a big operation, somebody would have talked. It did not become public until a book was written about it in 1995, and so on and so on. So it's just not true. And furthermore, think about it. If you were involved in the operation, you would be guilty of treason, mass murder. Are you going to start waving your hand and say, well, you know, guess what I did?
Right.
Unless there is some sort of official calling for testimony and, in fact, demanding testimony. We learned this with Scooter Libby and all that. People will talk once they're subpoenaed and they're threatened with prison. They will expose higher-ups. You give immunity to the lower people and protection, and say if you don't talk, you are going to prison the rest of your life, or worse, and people will talk. But now, there's not only is there no encouragement, but anybody who does talk is ridiculed and, you know, called a conspiracy theory, a nut job and all of that. There is no reward for talking. There is punishment for talking. Who's going to talk?
Well, David, I have to say, and this is the last thing I'll say, is that there are certain people well-known in the Boston area on certain radio stations that wouldn't have you on because you're a conspiracy person.
Sure, but they'll have Philip Zelikow on, even though he's the author of the most massive conspiracy theory.
Exactly.
You know, the most ridiculous conspiracy theory ever authored, that Osama bin Laden and 19 young men conspired to defeat the most powerful military defense system in history and to bring down two steel frame buildings at free fall speed by crashing planes into two of them.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not a conspiracy theorist.
If we could, I'd like to look again at one of the details that is quite telling in this, and that is that, and as far as my living memory goes, every airline crash that has ever occurred has been subjected to a rigorous examination and reconstruction of the aircraft. To the best of my knowledge, that was not conducted with any of the flights involved or if so, none of the evidence was released. Do you have any knowledge on this?
Well, of course, none of the planes were reconstructed because, as we've already said, the alleged planes did not land in Pennsylvania or in Washington, D.C. So, obviously, now, they've claimed that the plane that hit the Pentagon is all reconstructed and is there in a building. But, you know, let's show it to a reporter and let's have a few photographs of it. Let's have an unveiling and so on. On the contrary, there were 85 videos trained on the Pentagon that morning. The Department of Justice has admitted this. But if you submit a FOIA request for these that would show maybe what did or didn't hit the Pentagon, they'll tell you, no, these are not subject to the Freedom of Information Act because national security is involved.
Mm-hmm. One other item that perhaps you could expand on a bit for us, and you did touch on this briefly, but the personnel roster for the attacks, whether or not Osama bin Laden was involved, the backgrounds of the purported hijackers.
Well, this is another thing the FBI has revealed that, you know, if you go on the website and look under Osama bin Laden, spell it with a U, Osama bin Laden, you'll find he's wanted for a bunch of terrorist acts, but he's not wanted for 9/11. When the FBI was asked why not, the chief of investigative publicity said, because we have no hard evidence that Osama bin Laden was responsible for 9/11. Again, our free press will not report that to the American people. As to the hijackers, the official list that were released from the airlines had none of the names of the hijackers on it. In fact, they didn't have any Muslim names whatsoever. Now, in the meantime, an alleged copy has shown up that does have the names of the alleged hijackers on it, but this showed up 3 or 4 years later when there was plenty of time to fabricate it. And we also know that there's a big problem there, and I reported this in 9/11 Contradictions, because this list has some names on it, you know, that said this is the list that was released to the FBI immediately by the airlines that morning. And yet it has names on it that were not on the list the first day. This list kept changing because some of the people they first blamed as hijackers turned out a couple of them turned out to be still alive. One of them turned out he had died the year before. And so on. And even Hani Hanjour was not on the list in the first place. And, you know, there are top stories in the Washington Post speculating, why wasn't Hani Hanjour's name on there, you know, and all that, you know. He didn't get put on till the second day. And yet they're claiming that this list that has Hani Hanjour's name on it was the list that was released on 9/11 itself. So we know that's a lie. So, no, there were no hijackers, no Arabs whatsoever on the list of passengers put out from the planes.
This sort of the summation of all of these examples of blatant revisionism and facts misaligning, how do we overcome the false equivalency of unfounded arguments versus the type of painstaking research that has been done by yourself and others in terms of the weight it's given by our media?
Well, of course, that's the biggest nut to crack. And as I say, we don't know, you know, we're not privy to what goes on in the boardrooms of the media, to what extent they're consciously in collusion with the perpetrators of the official story, or how much they're just afraid to reveal the truth. You know, there's reason to suspect that it's the former because the media, the way they've been agglomerated in the last decades, they're all owned by a few giant corporations which are getting rich off of these so-called war on terror. So they've got every motivation to want to keep the official story going. By the way, I've just I've got a new, a little book that's going to come out more quickly called Osama bin Laden, Dead or Alive, and I present the evidence that he's been dead since December 14th, 2001. It's amazing that we can pinpoint it, but there's pretty good evidence that he died on either the 13th or the 14th, part of that evidence being that funeral announcement on the 15th. And, you know, this they won't publicize this. Now, in the early years, there was a little reporting on people who were saying, well, maybe Osama's dead. But at some point, it evidently became important to make sure that he was still alive. And since then, the mainstream media will not report evidence that he's long been dead. Former CIA operative Robert Baer, you know, who wrote the book that the movie Siriano was somewhat based on, he's very clear that Osama's most likely dead, and he said this on Terry Gross's show, Fresh Air, right? But no mainstream media picked up this revelation, even though you would think Baer, being a pretty well-known CIA former operative, would have some credibility. So it's just very tough. All I can say is that the 9/11 Truth Movement just needs to keep plugging along. And actually, we are continuing to grow both in numbers and in credibility. As I say, all of these organizations and a growing list of very reputable people who are saying the official story is obviously false. And so we're far stronger, both in numbers and in credible organizations and spokesperson, than we were just 2 years ago. So when you combine that with the fact that now we do have an administration where there's at least a chance, where there was really no chance before, there's at least a chance, I won't estimate the percentage, but there is a chance that there could be an investigation. Why, we've got every reason not only not to give up, but to redouble our efforts. And so I'm glad that people like you are having this radio show.
It's interesting that when the new Pearl Harbor was first published back in 2004, it was panned broadly, and also by Publishers Weekly, which called its claims ridiculous. But that same organization, Publishers Weekly, chose to put your 2008 book, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, as pick of the week.
I'm glad you brought this up because this is, in fact, part of my argument that it's time for a second look and that there might be a second look in the culture at large, because not only was my first book panned, but they rolled their eyes at the second one, too, which was my 9/11 Commission report, Omissions and Distortions, where I just went through point by point and pointed out all the false statements in the 9/11 Commission report. I had about 115 of them. If I were rewriting the book today, it would be well over 300. And they ridiculed that one, too. And yet, as you say, the new Pearl Harbor Revisited was the pick of the week for the week of November 24th, 2008. So they only have actually 51 picks of the week each year. So, you know, with some exaggeration, you could say they were saying this was one of the 51 best books of the year. And the author of this review took on this conspiracy theory canard and actually pointed out that you can't reject this sort of thing out of hand because the official theory is a conspiracy theory too. So the only question is which one has the better argument for it, which one has the better evidence. So this was a very remarkable cultural shift between 2004 and 2008. And so if Publishers Weekly is able to make that shift, and by the way, they are the Bible for bookstores and libraries. They're the ones, you know, they look to that to say which books of the thousands of books we could possibly order, which ones are worth ordering. They look to Publishers Weekly. So this is quite a statement on Publishers Weekly's part and may represent a more general cultural shift that will say, you know, now not only can we see good reason to believe maybe the worst about the Bush-Cheney administration, but also maybe we can come out now and say it in public.
Now, your first book on the topic, I believe, was The New Pearl Harbor. You've chosen to somewhat reuse that title for your most recent work of New Pearl Harbor Revisitus. Could you explain to us why?
Well, because so many people kept saying, well, you've got to do an updated version of this. And I thought, well, why should I do an updated version? I've written all these other books, and that's the ongoing updating of the story. Say, oh, yeah, but still, the New Pearl Harbor, that's the book, and that's the one everybody knows about. And so unless it says New Pearl Harbor, you know, people aren't going to get the information. Well, I didn't want to go through. Part of the reason it still, of the books, the best-selling one, is that it reads rather quickly. It's still the best read of all the books, everybody tells me. But, of course, it is out of date, terribly out of date, and also there were some errors in it. So I thought, well, okay, what I could do is write a new book, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, and make the two of them a two-volume set. And so that's essentially what we have now. It's a brand-new book. It doesn't repeat anything in there. It presupposes The New Pearl Harbor. But if you have the two books, then you got not everything, but everything you need to know the basics about both 9/11 and the official arguments to support it, and then all the evidence against it. Instead of my telling people, well, you've got to read these seven books if you want. Now all they have to do is really read those two books.
Now, we had mentioned a few moments ago how Publishers Weekly seems to be coming around a bit. There's also a new group that has been formed. I believe it's called Political Leaders for 9/11 Truth.
Yes, I say that's the newest of all the organizations. And if you go on the website, if you just go on Google and say, you know, Political Leaders for 9/11 Truth, you'll find it. Or if you want to go right to it, it's just pl911truth.com. And read the statement, and you'll see what these political leaders say. By the way, it's led by Yukihisa Fujita, who is the Japanese senator who spoke out during an official Senate committee meeting and challenged the official story, gave about a 40-minute talk, complete with diagrams and all, showing all sorts of problems in the official story. He was arguing that Japan shouldn't continue to support America's so-called war on terror. And then there's Karen Johnson, who was a state senator in Arizona and had spoken out on the floor of the Arizona Senate. So these two started this organization and wrote a very nice statement, and then there's a petition calling actually on President Obama to authorize a new, this time truly independent investigation. The site even talks about Philip Zelikow and why the 9/11 Commission was not at all independent, and neither was NIST. Started with really 10 members, and now I say has about over 40 members, and about half of those are pretty high-level members, former U.S. Congress people, and then we have two senators from Japan, we have two sitting senators, two former senators from Italy, some members of the European Union, both past and present, and the former Governor Jesse Ventura. And so it's quite a reputable group of people that have been willing to sign this document.
Speaking of European politicians, how has your reception in Europe differed from here in the United States?
Well, in some countries, I can actually appear on mainstream television, when I was in London before I did appear. I won't this time, although I think I will be on Irish television. Before I was on Norwegian television, I don't know if I will be this year, although I'll be going back there. So in terms of the general public, there is actually growing interest in Europe. The 9/11 truth movements are growing quite rapidly there. When the person who wanted to organize a tour for me sent out letters to 10 different cities, mainly 10 different, well, about 8 different countries, asking if they would want to sponsor a lecture by me, even though they had just got done sponsoring a lecture by architect Richard Gage, they all immediately said yes. So there is high interest over there because they're very aware, of course, that they're still wrapped up in the war on terror, in Afghanistan in particular. But it's a much more pervasive thing than just that, but that's the most obvious part. So there's a lot of high motivation there to get the truth revealed. And I'm willing to go over there and spend several weeks touring around because actually it'll be somewhat more realistic that we could get some sort of official investigation over there where, you know, you wouldn't have representatives or the new president accusing the old president or authorizing an investigation of the previous president. I mean, that should happen, but the chances of it happening aren't very high, although there's still a chance. But the chances are higher that we might get some sort of high-level, maybe even government investigation in the European Union or in the United Nations.
Well, David Ray Griffin, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to speak with you, and we hope all of our audience can make it out to see you April 11th, 2009 at Boston University, 9/11, time for a second look.
Thank you.